Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
A new president, a new day, the good and the not so good for labor, Trump and the Actors Union. Well, you know where this story is going. And today on the show, Debt in America and the North Coast Labor Federation. Good afternoon and welcome to the Thursday, January 21st edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on various platforms and adding more platforms. Announced yesterday, we're now on Pandora. So we got Pandora, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Spotify. And again, when you get an opportunity, just sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis, and eventually give us a rating. 5 stars would be most certainly appreciated. We have two guests today. Astra Taylor will be joining us on behalf of The Nation magazine. We do this segment on the third Thursday of each and every month, and the article is titled The Case for Wide-Scale Debt Relief. Astra is co-founder of the Debt Collective, and she'll explain what the Debt Collective is all about. She has written for the New York Times, the LA Times, publication called The Baffler, and she also authored The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age and Democracy. The article is quite fascinating, and she points out that even before the pandemic hit us last year, total household debt in the country, total debt, had reached a record-breaking $14 trillion. $14 trillion. And that's the result of decades, and I mean decades, of low wages and slash social services. And she points out that when the CARES Act was passed last March, which put, what was it, $1,200 in the pocket of every individual who's making, I believe, less than $75,000, 30% of those stimulus checks went to service debt. That's a lot. That's a lot. So she's of the opinion that we need to cancel, number one, all federal student loan debt, which is higher than credit card debt. And that would actually create jobs. She'll explain that on the show. Medical bills. Now, we have a lot of medical bills in this country because we don't have single-payer health care. You go abroad in Europe, Australia, Canada, that kind of thing does not exist. Cities and states are hurting. And that's because the federal government didn't help them out on the pandemic. So they had to use their own resources. And here's the difference. The federal government does not have to balance their budget. The states and the cities have to. Different case there. Congress has a lot of leverage on all of this. And Astra says Congress should actually cancel rents and mortgages, cancel all rental debt, erase COVID evictions from people's records, and pass a full eviction moratorium that bans filings, hearings, and all evictions. Pretty radical. But it can be done. And she says it should be done. It needs to be done. So Astra Taylor, on behalf of The Nation magazine, will be our first guest. We'll check in with Pat Gallagher, who heads the North Coast Area Labor Federation, part of the AFL-CIO, and also the steelworkers. And a sad note, too. He sent me this just the other day. Frank Valenta. I don't know if many of you know Frank. My dad knew him extremely well. He was the district director of Steelworkers District 28. It's now District 1. They've changed a lot. But he was 93 years of age. In fact, we've had him on the show a couple of times talking about what happened in the steel industry. He was also president of the Ohio AFL-CIO. He passed away on Sunday, January 10th, lived just outside Pittsburgh. So I'm sure he'll reflect on that and talk about the new administration. Lots of news. And I'm going to get to some of it here in a minute. But Pat really has his finger on the pulse and pretty much covers the entire state of Ohio, which is, like I said, now District 1. Speaking of the inauguration yesterday, I just have a comment here from Senator Sherrod Brown, who is a huge supporter of Biden-Harris. He was really giddy about what happened yesterday, and he pointed out a record-breaking 81 million Americans gave Joe and Kamala a mandate to heal this country, to defeat this pandemic, and to restore people's faith in our government. He went on to say this inauguration marks the end of the Trump administration's phony populism and broken promises, and the beginning of new leadership committed to healing our country and building it back better so it works for everyone, not just those at the top. Joe Biden campaigned as the Dignity of Work candidate. And now, with a Democratic Senate majority to back him up, we're going to govern that way. While the pain of the recent attack on our Capitol and our democracy by white supremacist domestic terrorists is still fresh in our minds, today, democracy prevails. Isn't that amazing? That insurrection happened 2 weeks before yesterday, Inauguration Day, 2 weeks before. Sherrod goes on to say, we are now on a path toward creating meaningful change in our country that makes a real difference in people's lives. And we've made it here because of grassroots activists like you who never gave up on our democracy. Great day for our country. Richard Trumka, who heads the Labor Federation, said this Inauguration Day was more solemn because of the crisis facing our nation and the violence that overtook Capitol Hill. We recognize the threats facing our democracy, and working people will never back down in the face of violent extremism. We will join together, like we always do, in defense of our democracy. This is the legacy of the labor movement, a legacy we are very proud to carry forward. Now, after he issued that statement, I'm speaking about Rich Trumka, he came out with another statement about the firing, the termination, the ending of the career for Peter Robb, who is the general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board. Now, if you've been listening to this show for any duration, you've heard me and our labor attorney that we feature every month, Joyce Goldstein, talking about the role of Peter Robb. And I have said many times he had the appropriate last name because he robbed workers of their rights. This is what Trumka said yesterday. In his first hours in office, President Joe Biden has taken immediate action to secure the rights and protect the well-being of America's working families by removing Peter Robb as NLRB general counsel. A union-busting lawyer by trade, Mr. Robb mounted an unrelenting attack for more than 3 years on workers' rights to organize and engage in collective bargaining. His actions sought to stymie the tens of millions of workers who say they would vote to join a union today and violated the stated purpose of the National Labor Relations Act, which was to encourage collective bargaining. Robb's removal is the first step toward giving workers a fair shot again, and we look forward to building on this victory by securing a worker-friendly NLRB and passing the PRO Act so all working people have the freedom to form a union. Now, this is significant because Robb had, I believe, 7 more months to go. However, the president of the United States does have the power to say, hey, you know what, buddy? Your time is up. And that's exactly what he did yesterday. So that is certainly good. Well, we need to change that agency and change it right away. I'm telling you, it's long, long overdue. Now, for the bad news. Keystone Pipeline. And I mentioned this on the show the other day, because we're talking about 2,000, at least 2,000 union jobs. And we're talking good-paying union jobs. And the building trade sent a letter to the president-elect at the time. And I don't know if he received it. It might be in a pile on his desk. I don't know. But hopefully Biden will take another look at this, because here's the latest. The Canadian company behind the Keystone XL oil pipeline said last night that it has suspended work on the pipeline Biden's day one plan included revoking a permit for the pipeline. That was in his executive orders that he announced yesterday. The 1,700-mile pipeline would carry roughly 800,000 barrels of oil a day from Alberta to the Texas Gulf Coast. This would go through Montana, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, and Oklahoma. The company, TC Energy, will review the decision, assess its implications, and consider its options. However, as a result of the expected revocation of the presidential permit, advancement of the project will be suspended. That company, by the way, is based in Calgary, Alberta. This is a long, winding story. It goes back to 2008, 12 years ago. The pipeline since has become emblematic of the tensions between economic development and curbing fossil fuel emissions that are causing climate change. The Obama administration rejected it, but Donald Trump revived it and has been a strong supporter, and construction already started. Canadian officials try to make the case for the pipeline to the incoming Biden administration. Prime Minister Trudeau, in fact, raised Keystone as a top priority when he spoke with Biden in a phone call. That was back in November. The project is meant to expand critical oil exports for Canada, which, by the way, has the third largest oil reserves in the world. I didn't realize they had so much. Jason Kenney, premier of the oil-rich province of Alberta, said late Tuesday that he urged Trudeau to tell Biden that rescinding the Keystone XL border crossing permit would damage U.S.-Canadian relations. Trudeau and Biden are politically aligned, and there are expectations for a return to normal relations after 4 years of Trump. But the pipeline, well, that's going to cause some tension. Trudeau has tried to balance the oil industry's desire for more pipelines with concerns by environmentalists. Boy, that's been going on for years. And he, in fact, canceled one major pipeline to the Pacific Coast from Alberta, but approved another and instituted a national carbon tax. So right now, work is suspended. I could only imagine. We're going to stay on this issue, I promise you, because the building trades support this show called America's Workforce. And we're talking good-paying jobs, steelworkers' jobs, too, because we're talking about pipe and what's pipe made out of steel. So we're working to get Sean McGarvey. We're going to start with him, who is the head of the National Building Trades, and talk more about this. Right now, though, I got to take a break. You're listening to America's Workforce, our segment with The Nation magazine on debt in America, coming up next.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Nurses, doctors, and caregivers at the VA are under attack. They face hostile management, callous agency heads, and an administration that's stomping all over their ability to speak up for our veterans. Unions are even being kicked out of their offices, a direct attempt to silence the voice of VA employees. When VA workers are under attack, veterans pay the price. Costly privatization and outsourcing will run rampant, meaning fewer services and worse quality of care for our nation's heroes. It's time to stand up for the workers who care for our veterans. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And we're back. It's America's Workforce. Don't forget, we're available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and most recently, Pandora. You can check us out on Pandora. Also, follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to line number one. And welcome to the show. This is a segment we do each and every month with one of the writers, fantastic writers, I might add, with The Nation magazine. Her name is Astra Taylor. She's also co-founder of the Debt Collect Collective, that is, and the director of the documentary film, What is Democracy? She's also written for the New York Times, the LA Times, The Baffler, and other outlets. Astra, welcome to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today.
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And you were telling me off the air that you did your first article for The Nation some years ago. What was it, 2003, 2004? Is that right?
Indeed, it was my very first ever published article, an account of a march with ADAPT, which is the famous disability rights group that helped get us the ADA and have been pushing for what they call attendant care. So the right to have support for disabled people who want to live in their communities and live in their homes. And so that was the very first piece I ever wrote for The Nation. And here I am quite a while later. Still plugging away.
There you go. And the most recent article is The Case for Wide-Scale Debt Relief. There's a lot of components to it, but before we get into it, I mentioned the Debt Collective. You're a co-founder of that organization. Give me some details. What is the Debt Collective?
I hope that you like the concept, being a pro-labor radio show, because we're very much inspired by labor unions and by the idea and the model of worker organizing. And our aim is to build, just like workers have to come together and form unions to fight for higher wages and benefits on the job, to wrest some power away from employers, we think that debtors can come together to build collective power and engage in something that looks like collective bargaining, try to get write-downs, debt cancellation, and ultimately help push for policies that would stop people from going into debt in the first place. So if you have universal health care, you're not going to go bankrupt because of medical debt, right? If you have not just affordable but free public education, then you don't have to take out student loans. And if you're paid enough on the job, then you don't have to take out a predatory payday loan to make it to the end of the month. So it's a model that we think complements a lot of the efforts going on, right? You know, because in a way, our debts are kind of wage theft because we're not paid enough, and then we have to borrow and pay interest and pay all these fees. So we're kind of robbed twice. And the idea is basically that over the last 40 years, wages have stagnated for working people, and then we've covered that up with access to credit. And so, you know, that prosperity has not been broadly shared. And what we've seen is an explosion of debt. And there's this idea, of course, that, oh, if you take on debt, it's your fault and you haven't managed your money. But, you know, if you're not paid enough to live and you're denied services, then this isn't a product of bad individual choices. It's about a system that is designed, you know, to keep people not just poor, but indebted.
Astra, to your point about debt, I heard a line, this was some years ago, it costs a lot to be poor. And when you think about that, it costs a lot to be poor. How is that? Think of the person that has a car, an older car, it breaks down. You need to get that car fixed to get to your job or to go to school. And you don't have the money in the bank, so you go to the payday loan store, and then they charge you ridiculous fees. We have a real big problem in the state of Ohio with that issue. They've tried to rein it in, and they're still, I mean, you're seeing 28, 35, 36% interest rates, and it's a never-ending cycle. Then that same person, especially if you live in an impoverished neighborhood, you go to the small stores, what do? They charge you more for household goods. So it's a constant cycle, and that's why it costs so much to be poor. So this Debt Collective, I'm reading, it's a union for debtors then? Can you tell me how effective it has been since you started this?
Well, I mean, you've outlined the problem so correctly, this idea that it actually costs more to be poor, right? Because if you have, and then let's say that you take out this payday loan and you can't pay it back on time. And then your credit score gets blasted and then you're charged even more down the road. So this is the debt trap that people get into. And it's a trap by design, right? Because creditors like what they call revolvers. They don't want people to pay up and settle their debts once and for all because then they won't make any more money, right? So we're put into this cycle on purpose. The Debt Collective is a relatively new organization. We launched our first debtors union in 2015. It was a group of students who had been defrauded by a predatory for-profit college chain. These companies that call themselves schools are not small fry. They serve hundreds of thousands of students at a time, and they manage to access federal money. So you can get a student loan, just exactly the same student loan you'd get to go to the University of Ohio or to go to Harvard, only it's to go to University of Phoenix or DeVry, or in this case, Everest Colleges, these other colleges under this Corinthian banner. And these, I mean, I won't bore you with the details of all the ways these schools lied to students and then, you know, didn't give them an education worth anything. And it was all based on the idea, oh, this is how you get out of poverty. You go to school mm-hmm. and you're finally able to make more than whatever it is, $7.25 an hour, right? You know,
right.
And
right.
These degrees aren't worth anything. So what 15 students, and it was very small at first that we did some deep organizing with, launched a strike. They called themselves the Corinthian 15 and said, we can't pay our loans and we're not going to pay. We were lied to and these schools broke the law. That grew into a movement of hundreds and then thousands on strike. And then we coupled that with legal strategies. So we built this app so people could finally exercise their rights that were on the books, which overwhelmed the Obama Department of Education. And we ended up winning over $1 billion through various strategies, $1 billion of federal student loan relief and changes to federal law, and showed the political class that debt cancellation is possible. And so it influenced Elizabeth Warren and her campaign promises around debt cancellation, and Bernie Sanders, and ultimately Joe Biden, who campaigned and won the election promising mass student debt relief. So we're still pushing him, but really the union, this experiment, we call it a pilot, shows mm-hmm. that debtors uniting can actually get the goods.
What a novel idea. Collective action. How about that, Astra?
Exactly. I mean, this is the thing. You know, I love labor unions, and I wish they were way more prevalent because they're good for democracy. They're good for all kinds of things, right? They mitigate inequality.
Yeah.
They're good for democracy. But we can take that model into other corners of our economic lives. And so many people, debt sticks to you. So you lose your job, you lose your job. You lose your relationship with your boss. But if you lose mm-hmm. your job or you go back to school for a while or you're retired, your debt sticks to you. So there's a challenge in organizing debtors because you don't share a workplace, so it can be kind of hard to find each other, and it's hard to have that day-to-day connection. But one of the strengths of it is that these debts are so tenacious, and they follow us sometimes to the grave and beyond. And so we're tired of acting like they're just a natural part of life. We want to show that actually, this is part of a system, and it can be changed.
And right now, federal student loan debt is higher than credit card debt in America. It's been that way for a number of years. And I know you are, in your article for The Nation, point out that it's probably a good time to just wipe it off the books. I mean, wipe it off the books.
Yeah.
Going that far, that's a radical idea, especially the conservatives. Just say, wait a minute, these kids, they got to pay their loans. Do you think it's doable then? Is that what I'm hearing in your article?
I don't think it's doable. I know it's doable. And for people who think it's some radical new idea, I'd say, hey, go back a generation or two. Look at the GI Bill. There's a good chance that grandpa didn't graduate with student loans, or maybe even our parents' generation, depending on, who we're talking about. I mean, student loans were so trivial, they weren't really measured by economists until the 90s. So it's a kind of post-Reagan era development that we debt finance education. I mean, in fact, the big universities, the big public universities and colleges in this country, typically have sort of charters that say this is for the public education is something that people are entitled to for free. So this is actually an American principle. And the thing is that the government has the executive branch has the power to cancel all student debt, to kind of say, okay, this experiment with student loans was a policy failure. It wasn't working. There's lots of evidence, for example, that the $1.7 trillion of student debt in this country is holding back economic growth. It's causing people to delay having families. Younger people can't buy homes. A lot of older people have student debt, and when they've defaulted, their Social Security gets garnished and all sorts of bad things happen. So it's one of these things that's gotten so out of hand, it's really hurting people. And it turns out through our legal research and now quite a few senators and political figures agree that there's something called Compromise and Settlement Authority. It's in the Higher Education Act of 1965. And it basically, if the government can create debt, it's allowed to cancel it. So with a stroke of a pen, Joe Biden's Secretary of Education can erase all federal student debt today. And we are building a movement. In fact, 100 people declared themselves on debt strike on day one of the Biden administration. They're called the Biden Jubilee 100. It's gig workers. There's doctors. There's a pastor. There's a grandma. There's young people. It's a diverse group of people who really represent America today. And they're saying, you know, not just for us, but for the good of our communities and to boost the economy, cancel all student debt. We know you can do it.
Boy, they couldn't wait for Biden to get in office.
We've been chomping at the bit fighting Betsy DeVos for 4 years, so we're tired.
Yeah.
We're ready for new adversaries.
I hear you. You point out in your article, Astra, that canceling all federal student debt would boost the economy, and here's the number, $108 billion a year, and on top of it, add up to 1.5 million jobs a year, and there's another component, help close the racial wealth gap. Now, how did you arrive at those numbers? Can I ask you that?
Yeah, that's through work. A lot of economists have been crunching these numbers for years. So the $108 billion figure comes from the Levy Institute. Some of your listeners might know the economist Stephanie Kelton, but she was one of the economists on that study. I mean, but it makes actually just common sense, right? So the average student borrower is paying $300, $400 a month, but some people are paying $1,000 or more a month. If you're not sending that to Uncle Sam, right, for your monthly payments, you're spending mm-hmm. that. You're spending that in your community. You're, again, using it maybe to save to buy a house. You're using it to pay for rent. And so it just makes intuitive sense that it would be an economic boost because that money would be going to pay for other things, the things that people need. I mean, what you see with the Biden Jubilee 100, and people can look at our website to see some of the stories, is people just, they can't get better housing and they can't save for retirement because of their student debt. And so these are also things that people would do that ultimately we'd all be better off, right? We're better off if our neighbors can actually have a secure retirement. We're better off if people aren't being evicted because they can't pay their rent. And so there's this collective boost. I think we have to think collectively, right? This isn't really just about the individuals who would get their student loan canceled. It's us as a society saying, maybe actually education isn't something that, you know, should be treated as a commodity. So therefore only the already wealthy get to go to school without this burden of student debt. And maybe I'd be better off if the people around me could actually buy the things they need to live instead of sending money to the federal government. And, you know, the federal government really doesn't need that money. The student loans have been suspended since the pandemic began. And, you know, I just want to, you know, the Department of Education hasn't collapsed.
Yeah, I hear you. You mentioned a website. Is that the Debt Collective website that you referenced? Can you give that to us real quick?
Yeah, debtcollective.org, and there's a page for the Biden Jubilee 100, and I think it's powerful, you know, because the numbers make us think in statistics, and it becomes a bit abstract and impersonal, and there you really see, you know, there are 45 million people who have student debt, and these 100 strikers are, you know, standing up, I think, for a lot of student debtors, and so you see their stories and the way that the student debt is destroying their lives and making their lives very insecure, very precarious. People can also join the union, which is a very important thing. We need people to join because there's power in numbers.
No doubt there's strength in numbers. Astra, I have to take a break. Astra Taylor joining us on Lifeline. She's one of the great writers for The Nation magazine. The title of the article is The Case for Wide-Scale Debt Relief. Now, we zeroed in on student loan debt, but there's more. We'll get into that. Pat Gallagher will be joining us later in the show. Pat with the North Coast Labor Federation and the Steelworkers. It's all part of America's Workforce. Back in a few.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with prostate, breast, or any other cancer after taking Zantac? You may be entitled to compensation. The trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And welcome back to America's Workforce. Don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. Also, we're available now on Pandora. That was just added to the mix this week, by the way. All right, this next segment brought to you in part by the fine folks at the United Labor Agency. They connect people with employment, and you can find them online at ulagency.org. Let's go back to our live line and rejoin Astra Taylor. Astra is one of the great writers with The Nation magazine, also co-founder of the Debt Collective. And if you want a good website to check out, just go to debtcollective.org, debtcollective.org. And that's been updated because we have a new administration and we're expecting radical changes right away. No doubt about that. So the case for debt relief, we zeroed in on student loans, but you're taking it further. You're saying that Congress needs to cancel rents, mortgages. Are we getting into medical debt, too? Because isn't that like the leading cause of bankruptcies in America? Is that right, Astra?
Absolutely. And medical debt is something that doesn't exist in countries that have universal healthcare systems, right? So people are not burdened by medical debt in the United Kingdom, in Denmark, in Canada, and certainly not such a crisis that people who are already dealing with trying to get better from things like cancer, right, then have to think, how am I going to hold on to my home? Am I going to lose everything, even if I manage to not lose my life? And so this is one of these things. It's just ridiculous. And medical debt shouldn't exist. It certainly isn't something that should damage our credit scores, right? There's nothing similar between having to go to the emergency room and getting a $10,000 bill and, you know, putting a fancy new car on a credit card, right? I mean, they're just like, why do we treat these things as though they're financially similar arrangements when they're not? I think the idea of debt cancellation can strike people as very radical, but there's a long tradition of it. You know, this is something biblical tradition of the Jubilee, right, was about canceling the debts every 7 years and wiping the slate clean, because the fact is that debts tend to grow. That's what interest is. It compounds and they get out of hand. And when debt gets out of hand, it destabilizes society. Debts get out of hand because people fall so far into arrears that they have no hope of getting out. And so what you have to do at these moments is cancel debt. And there's a growing chorus of mainstream economists saying that and just saying that this country is so indebted. And the problem isn't, you know, we hear a lot about the national debt and the deficit from Republicans. That's not the issue. But personal debt is so extreme. In fact, it's now over $14 trillion in this country that it's actually holding back the economy. It's restraining growth and hurting us all. So there's a pragmatic economic case to be made for every type of debt you just listed. There's an economic case to like why it would actually benefit everybody to have these debts written down or canceled. And then there's an ethical case, which is, well, hold on, should medical debt even exist in the first place?
Mm-hmm. And you point out in your article that we have the money, and you kind of touched on this, but we have the money to cancel debt. And it seems we do. If there's a war, we're going to fund the war. I mean, if there's like, for instance, the CARES Act, they came up with that and they're going to do it again in this new administration. And unfortunately, and you point this out in your article, that a lot of people that got their stimulus checks, they use that to pay down their debt. They spend 30%, and this goes back last year, of their stimulus checks to service debt. So that being said, the government should just say, forget it. It's over with. We're done. Slate's clean. Move on. Right. Is that what I'm hearing?
That is what you're hearing. And again, you know, it's not just that we have the money, but actually that we would be collectively richer, because money would then be able to, people would have money to spend on other things. So exactly as you say, people spend an overwhelming amount of their stimulus checks just servicing debts, right? So that's not money being productively used. And we have to be, of course, like, we have to be strategic. So where does the incoming administration have the power to cancel debts? I mean, what I found in my research is, just like the government can cancel all federal student loans very easily without going through Congress, you do not need congressional action on this, the government could cancel all debts that are owed, all medical debts that are owed to military and veterans hospitals, right? So that's something that could be done. You could use legislation to do something much more bold and have the government actually decide to buy all past due medical debt and then extinguish it. So there's all sorts of creative solutions out there, but it's based on the fundamental rational economic recognition that debts that can't be paid won't. So you can keep punishing people, you can keep destroying their credit scores, you can keep adding on the fees and the interest, but if people don't have the money, they don't have the money, and it's better to sometimes face that fact and let your economy recover.
Astra, I also want to talk about cities and state governments, and you point this out in your article, that they've been hurting, especially with the pandemic, and they're doing a lot on their own because the federal government has been lax. So they are in need of extra money. They are in debt. Now, the best way to handle that, I'm reading here, is the Federal Reserve Board. Can you explain what the Fed can do to help out the cities and the states?
Yeah, I think it's really important that we understand the way public debt works. So at the national level, again, the Republicans love to talk about deficits, the national debt, as an excuse to not fund the programs we need. Of course, they always have money when there's a war or they need a tax cut or whatever.
Right.
But the federal government can print money and has the ability to pay for the things that will make us collectively richer. Cities and states don't. Cities and states are not able to print money. So they are under tight revenue conditions. And so exactly what you said, you know, with COVID, cities and states had to take on all of these expenses to deal with COVID that, you know, if we had had a semi-intelligent executive administration, somebody else in the White House, then the federal government would have stepped up and paid for that. So our cities and states are already having budget problems, and then it was made even worse. So what the Fed can do, even again without Congress, right, is the Fed has the ability to issue zero interest loans. They just need to be rolled over periodically. But what that allows, what that will do is get money to struggling municipalities and states at no interest, so that they can begin the recovery process. But now that we know that the Democrats control the Senate and the House, there's no reason for the federal government to not just issue grants to these communities. Again, because this is about getting people into a stable financial place so that we can have a real recovery. You know, this is about making sure that our schools don't crumble. This is making sure that our roads aren't dangerous and our bridges, you know, don't fall apart. And this is about making sure that there's, you know, a viable healthcare system. I mean, these are things that create, you know, shared wealth, shared prosperity. And so there's no reason for our communities to go deeper into debt and to pay huge fees to Wall Street, something like $160 billion a year. That's what our communities are paying in fees to Wall Street. And so this whole system needs to be reevaluated. And the Biden administration has a ton of tools in its toolkit. So we need to be pushed to use them. That's the real problem.
And that's why this hasn't changed. I mean, you hit it right on the head when you said Wall Street. Wall Street loves what's happening right now. They're making a whole lot of money on all of us, on this situation, including the governments, the state and local governments. It's really sad. But, you know, you mentioned 0% interest. I have to laugh because, you know, I'm thinking, Astra, if the car dealers can do it, it seems like the federal government. I don't know where you're in North Carolina. Here in the Cleveland, Ohio area, you see a lot of ads for 0% interest to get a new vehicle. 0% interest. Now, obviously, there's a lot of qualifications. You have to have a certain credit score and all that. But it can be done. It can be done. That's no doubt. No doubt about that. So moving forward, we have a new administration. I could tell you're excited. How do you feel about this? I mean, you got Congress here. You know, I mean, there's a lot of conservatives say, hey, you know, you did this. This was your choice. You wanted to go to that prestigious school. You got to pay the loans off. That's the way it is. Too bad. Good luck. How do you feel moving forward? What's your answer?
You know, my optimism is always it's optimism about the potential of organizing people. And I think we are, you know, we're in a moment where there's people are their expectations are raised with a new administration. And we're also talking about an administration that, you know, people are ready to push. When Obama took office, it's almost like social movements went home, you know, and I feel like with Joe Biden, we don't expect that he's a messiah. So I think people are ready to provide that outsider energy that's needed to get the kind of reforms that we need to meet this moment, right? We need New Deal style reforms. And so I'm enthusiastic to keep organizing. And I think we are in a moment too, where there's potential for a shift in consciousness in a good way. So for example, over the last year, a lot of people have had to rely on what are basically welfare benefits, right? Unemployment insurance. They've looked forward to getting those stimulus checks. And so I hope we can take this moment and destigmatize the idea of having aid and assistance from the state, right? That's not a bad thing. That's not a sign that you're weak. That's, you know, these are things that we're entitled to. So I want to take this moment and kind of strengthen that spirit of entitlement, that actually we deserve good wages. We deserve good jobs. We deserve good education. We deserve good health care. And we're seeing all of the risks of not having those things in this period of pandemic. So I'm ready for new adversaries. I'm happy to not have the main target for the debt collective be Betsy DeVos. So bring on the Democrats.
There you go. I love your attitude. Astrid, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Let's do this again. Let's stay on this issue. In the meantime, I want to drive everybody to that website, debtcollective.org. Let me repeat that, debtcollective.org. Astrid Taylor with The Nation magazine. She's written for various publications, including the New York Times, the LA Times. The case for wide-scale debt relief. We need it more now than ever before. You take care, be safe, and please keep in touch, okay?
Yep, thank you. Same to you.
Once again, Astrid Taylor, co-founder of the Debt Collective and contributor to The Nation magazine. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Pat Gallagher on behalf of the Steelworkers and the North Coast Labor Federation, right here on America's Workforce.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this upcoming segment is brought to you by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. Check them out online at oft-aft.org.
Mesothelioma is a rare type of cancer caused by exposure to asbestos. If you were exposed to asbestos and have mesothelioma or lung cancer, the trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And welcome back to America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora. Plus, you can follow us on Twitter. Nothing's changed there. AWF Union Podcasts. Before we get to Pat Gallagher and the North Coast Labor Federation and the Steelworkers. In fact, Pat, are you listening right now? Are you on line number two? Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I am, Flash.
Guess what? They might kick Trump out of the actors union. And I get a vote in this, too.
Well, I know which way my vote would go.
Let me tell you, the Screen Actors Guild, which merged with AFTRA, that's the American Federation of TV Radio Artists, and I've been a member of the union since 1974, they have voted to hold a disciplinary hearing for the now former president, and it's all because of what happened January 6th. The riots. The union emphasized the danger to its broadcast journalist members that Trump incited. And after the disciplinary hearing, two-thirds of the union could vote to suspend or expel Trump from its membership. Now, I don't think he's going to cry over this, knowing Trump, but nonetheless, this is significant. This is significant, and I'm happy because I have a vote in it. So anyway, just thought I'd share that story with you.
I have in recent years, seen a president that was more anti-union than Donald Trump. For him even to want a union membership is hypocrisy. What his policies was, putting Peter Robin as a general counsel, who's no longer the general counsel for the National Labor Relations Board, who's had a history of union busting and the architect of the air traffic controllers strike breaking activities and all the executive orders that came down. I mean, against federal, the ability of federal workers to bargain. I can't even think of a more anti-union president we've ever had. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that came down yesterday. I just mentioned that at the top of the show, and that's pretty significant because Rob actually had 7 more months to go. And I know some of the anti-union Republicans aren't too happy about that, but hey, you know what? Elections matter. So we're going to see a change of course here. You know, speaking of appointments, talk to me about the guy that you know very well that's going to be involved with OSHA. What's the story here, Pat?
Yeah, President Biden, when he appointed his transition team, he put several union members in there and several union people with union backgrounds. And he's put a bunch of appointments out there. And one of the appointments he made was to the Occupational Safety and Health, OSHA, was a guy by the name of James Frederick, who was the former assistant head of the United Steelworkers Safety and Health Environment Department in Pittsburgh. Jim's got a long history. He's an industrial hygienist. He's got a long history of supporting workers. He originally came out of the United Rubber Workers Union, and that was headquartered in Akron. Then when we merged with them back in the 90s, Jim moved to Pittsburgh and became the assistant head of our safety department. And a great guy, a great advocate for workers, and I think he'll be a marvelous addition to OSHA and really hopefully bring back worker safety as it should be, not as it turned into under the Trump administration.
Now, Pat, is this one of those appointments that have to be approved by Congress, or is this something that Biden couldn't just install himself?
Oh, this is something that Biden could do. It's not a cabinet-level position where it's got to get Senate approval by the Senate. So.
Good, 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 good. Do me a favor. If you could send me the contact information, tell them, say, hey, Flash would like to put him on America's Workforce. It would be. Or does he start right away on this position or what?
No, I'm not sure when he starts, but I will get in contact with them and let you know.
See what you can do. Okay, good.
Yep, sure.
Yeah, well, we're going to see some changes here. Biden's first priority, he was pretty clear on it, is the pandemic. He wants to get that under control as soon as possible. I mean, the start of his day and the end of the day, that's all he's got on his mind. And to Rich Trumka's point, he says once that takes hold, I'm going to work on the PRO Act, the Protect the Right to Organize. So with the makeup of Congress, we've got a Democratic House, a Democratic Senate now, as of yesterday. Democratic guy in the White House. How do you feel going forward?
Well, I feel pretty good about President Biden. I said for a change, I think we've got the most significant pro-labor and pro-worker administration that we've had. He's already came out and he said he's not afraid to use the word union. He's supporting the PRO Act, which strengthens labor laws and would hold executives accountable for interfering in attempts to organize, and it would strengthen our rights to bargain collectively, and that's what we need in our country. He's also a big supporter of infrastructure bill, which I think is after the pandemic, I think, is a number two priority we need to attack, is we need to get an infrastructure bill in our country. I've talked about this many times on the show. The American Society for Civil Engineers have released data that says that our infrastructure was $2 trillion in deficit. Now, that was some years ago, so that $2 trillion probably could be as much as $4 trillion now.
Mm-hmm.
President Biden's pledged as a plan to invest $1.3 trillion over 10 years, which I actually think I'd like to see a little bit more even in there and come up with a really strong infrastructure, because that helps the economy, it helps manufacturing. Another point I think President Biden needs to make is I think he needs to develop an industrial policy, a manufacturing policy, so that we can get our industry back on track and be the leader. I mean, the Chinese didn't go from being, you know, making the same amount of steel as we do to 10 times that amount right now by accident. It was the result of conscience decisions made by government to increase industry, and we need to have those same type of initiatives here in our country also.
Pat, are you following this Keystone XL pipeline situation? We're on it here on the show because we're talking union jobs here, and apparently in one of the executive orders, he nixed it yesterday because of the environmentalists have been taking this on for the last, my God, 10, 12 years. And, you know, you represent the steelworkers. We're talking pipe made by steelworkers. Do you think this could be turned around? Not only that,
Flash, but we represent a lot of workers in refineries, and that, you know, we find oil that couldn't gas that goes through these pipelines, so we need, you know, that's very important to us. You know, I mean, we've got to get a balance in between environmentalism and, you know, and our industry and our manufacturing. And that balance and pipeline actually is the cheapest way and the most safest way to move oil or gas through. It's a lot cheaper than trucking it. It's a lot cheaper and much more environmentally efficient than doing it, you know, trucking it or doing it by rail. So, I mean, it is an environmental sound practice to have pipelines, so we need to develop, you know, a balanced approach to how we deal with pipeline and with our use of carbon fuels in our country. And I think through that we do need some type of, you know, controls and transition. But right now we need to address the situation that we got to do immediately, and that's that we do need to have some type of environmentally sound system to be able to move oil and gas across our country, because in the short term, it's not going away anytime soon. So we need to make sure that we try to be environmentally responsible, and pipelines are the most environmentally sound mode of transportation for these products.
Yeah, I understand that the executive order kind of put a kibosh on it all, but I think this story is far from being over. We're talking too many jobs here. It's 100% union built, and overall, we're talking 10,000 union jobs. You don't want to do that right now. You don't want to do that. All right, one more issue here on a sad note. Frank Valenta, thanks for sending me the information on this. Frank was a big supporter of America's Workforce. We've had him on over the years, and in fact, he was the district director of, at the time, wasn't it District 28? It's now District 1, is that correct?
Yeah. Yes, District 28. Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Any words about Frank here as we wrap up this segment?
Yeah, Frank, unfortunately, Frank Valenta passed away. He was 93 years old on December 29th. He passed away on January 10th. Frank was a district director for United Steelworkers in northeastern Ohio for over 20 years. He was also president of the AFL-CIO, Cleveland AFL-CIO, for two different terms, once back in the 70s when the job was a full-time position, and then he went on later to be the president in the 80s also, too. He was a strong labor leader. He was influential in the Gateway Project. He was one of the supporters of getting that out and working on that campaign. He's done a lot of things that's helped our community, and it's a definitely sad day in the labor community, and Frank passes away.
He lived a good life, Frank Valenta, passing away at the age of 93.
Had a lot of influence on a lot of people, was a great labor leader, charismatic guy, and you know, Frank was the kind of guy, either you loved him or you hated him. He was just that type of individual who made things happen. And I've learned a lot from Frank, and I learned a lot of things not to do from Frank. And he's been a great role model for me and for others in other steelworkers. And it's just very sad of his passing.
Yeah, he was one heck of a guy. Frank Valenta passing away at the age of 93, 20 years as district director of the Steelworkers, District 28, which is now District 1 for the state of Ohio. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, our segment with Working Class Perspectives and the Steelworkers. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.